Hello and welcome to Max Politics. This is Ben Max. Thanks for tuning in for this episode of the show. We're speaking here on Thursday, March 7th, 2024. My guest on the show today is New York State Senate Deputy Leader Michael Janaris. He's a Queens Democrat. He's very involved in a few things that we're going to get to today, including the redistricting process in New York, the process by which New York state legislative districts and congressional districts are redrawn that may finally have had this cycle come to a close with congressional maps for the state's 26 seats in the U.S. House of Representatives passed by the state legislature, signed by the governor. No legal challenges to those maps on the horizon right now. That could still come. So nothing is for sure here in a process that has drawn out longer than it was supposed to and been much more controversial and contested than many would hope for. There have been multiple court battles and redrawing of maps and all that. So we're going to get into redistricting with Senator Janaris here, but also as the deputy leader of the state Senate and the supermajority that Democrats have in the state Senate, he is very involved in major policy and budget negotiations. So we're going to get into a little bit of that with him here today as well. A lot to dig in on with Senator Janaris as here on March 7th, we really get into crunch time where state budget negotiations will really ramp up. On Monday, March 11th, just a few days after we're speaking here, the state Senate Democrats are expected to unveil their one house state budget resolution and pass it later that week, along with the state assembly Democrats, where they also have a supermajority, will be expected to also be presenting their one house budget resolution and pass that. And that's really what kicks off the final weeks of negotiations between the two house majorities and the governor's office. Governor Kathy Hochul put forward her policy and budget agenda earlier this year. The state legislature held its annual hearings on the governor's budget proposal, discussing a number of policy and budget issues at those hearings. They heard from local officials like Mayor Eric Adams about New York City's needs and the needs of other localities and so forth. And now the two majorities putting together their one house budget resolutions to help form more of the basis of those negotiations. The state fiscal year begins on April 1st, we are very likely to see a state budget passed either sometime later in April or maybe even early May. Last year it was passed in early May, I believe. The state budget often comes in at least a few days late. Sometimes they have to pass what are known as budget extenders to keep the current fiscal year spending plan in place and pay the state's bills, especially to its workers and so forth, while they finalize the new spending plan. The state budget very often has a lot of policy in it as well. There's a lot of debate about how much policy should be in the budget, but that's also part of negotiations as well. So that's about to kick into high gear here, and we'll be getting into a lot of that here on the show in the coming weeks. Going to focus a lot in this discussion with Senator Janaris on some broader issues in the state, on the redistricting process, what's gone wrong, what comes next, and all that. A little bit on some of those budget and policy issues, but to get out ahead of the one house budget resolutions doesn't make a lot of sense. We'll be having further conversations here on the show once we see those state legislative budget resolutions and get into those negotiations with Governor Hochul and her team. So more conversation on a lot of that to come here on the show. If you're a regular listener, you know we focus a lot on housing and housing policy. And so that's obviously a main focus of people wondering when and if the state leaders will come to a big housing policy package that was elusive last year, that may or may not happen in the state budget. It could happen in the legislative session weeks to follow. The session goes through early June. It's an election year for state legislators, of course. So that factors in, and the calendar around that also factors into what does and does not get done. So a lot to watch for, and we'll be discussing a lot of it here on the show and also getting into some with Senator Janaris on his specific priorities, like a package of funding that he wants to see for certain expansion of bus service and also free bus service in New York City. So we'll get into that and a whole bunch of other things with him here on the show today. We are coming to you from New York Law School and its Center for New York City Law, where I'm executive editor and program director. We've been bringing you, of course, Max Politics here. We're also ramping up in-person events at New York Law School and the Center for New York City Law. We've had some great recent events in the ongoing series known as the City Law Breakfast, hosted by Professor Ross Sandler here, who is the founder and director of the Center for New York City Law, but also adding some other recent and upcoming events. So be on the lookout for those and excited about some of that programming that we have coming to you. And of course, we have the in-depth policy and politics conversations here on the podcast continuing. If you've missed any recent episodes of the show, do check them out after you listen to this one. Just a few quick highlights of recent conversations include a really good conversation on childcare policy in New York with Grace Rao, the executive director of the think tank, the Five Borough Institute, on their new report on childcare policy. Prior to that, I spoke with New York State Inspector General Lucy Lang on her office's efforts to root out corruption and waste and abuse in New York state government. Prior to that, had on State Senator John Liu of Queens on his role, especially with oversight of New York City schools and education and the question of the extension of mayoral control of New York City schools, which is up for potential renewal this year, set to expire in June. And before that, a great conversation with New York City Health Commissioner Dr. Ashwin Vasin about how the Adams administration is addressing public health and the impacts of social media on youth mental health specifically, and then a bunch of other great episodes in the feed. So check them all out when you get a chance. A lot to discuss here on the show today with State Senate Deputy Leader Michael Janaris, but just also as a preview, once the State Senate One House budget resolution is out, I do plan to have back on the show State Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins, hopefully to discuss the State Senate's budget resolution and where that then heads into the final weeks of budget negotiations with Governor Kathy Hochul and the State Assembly Democrats. So stay tuned for that conversation, hopefully in the coming weeks, as well as other state legislators and others to talk about the really important state budget process, which again could have a whole host of different policy elements to it. There are many priorities that Mayor Adams has put forward that he wants to see in the state budget, both on funding and policy. Many other stakeholders that want to see certain things. The state budget will be clocking in at somewhere around $230 billion. And that is also relates to a number of policy decisions that might be made. Again, could be in the budget, could be kicked out of the budget on policy, but a lot of funding decisions certainly to be made in the coming days and weeks. Okay, State Senate Deputy Leader Michael Janaris is with me. He's a Queens Democrat representing the 12th State Senate District in Western Queens, including parts or all of Astoria, Sunnyside, Woodside, Maspeth, and other parts of the borough. He's been the Deputy Majority Leader since Democrats took control of the State Senate in 2019, an effort that he helped spearhead because in his political role, he also leads the state Senate's Democratic campaign arm. Welcome, Senator Janaris. Thanks for coming back on the podcast. How are you today?
I'm good, Ben. Let's not leave out Ridgewood or Elmhurst either. Some great neighborhoods.
Try not to list all the neighborhoods. Yes. Appreciate that. So before we get into a whole lot of other things, I wanted to get your quick reaction to the governor. Governor Hochul ordering National Guard troops into the subway system to do bag checks. She's putting National Guard, state police, et cetera, bolstering the city's NYPD presence in the subways. This seems to be an alternative to sending the city more money for overtime for NYPD. And then she's had a couple of comments in recent days when rolling this plan out about how if people don't want to submit to a bag check without probable cause, that they can go home and not ride the subways. What's your reaction to this plan? And I don't know, is this anything where the legislature might weigh in any way?
Well, as an initial matter, let me just say, we all want people to feel safe using public transit. And it remains an overwhelmingly safe place to be within the confines of the city. And so it's important to recognize that, but also acknowledge that the perception people have is very, very relevant, and we need to be sensitive to that. That being said, I think the action needs to match the concern. And I don't know that, you know, the violent actions that have occurred on the subway result from people carrying weapons and bags. Usually bag checks are something we associate with anti-terrorism measures. And so it's not that we're so much facing acts of terrorism on the subway as random acts of violence, which we need to deal with. So I guess I don't really know what stopping people and checking their bags is going to do to actually solve the problem or people's perception of the problem. And of course, you now open the door to an old problem that we were hoping to have moved away from, which is who's getting stopped and checked. And I suspect that white man in a suit going to work is not going to be stopped to have his backpack checked, but certain demographics will. And it's a little bit of a dangerous game that is being played with New Yorker civil liberties.
So I was going to ask you in this conversation if there feels like something of a relief that there doesn't seem to be a big focus on reforming the bail reforms yet again this year, and that if that's something that seems to be settled for now. But then you have Mayor Adams and NYPD representatives presenting figures around subway safety that relate to recidivists and questions about both the specifics of the bail reform law, but also how judges are implementing it, also district attorneys, but in many cases, judges. What do you make of that discussion? And is there something further that needs to be done related to the state's bail laws and recidivism? Discussion about judicial implementation, but that seems to have fallen off. The governor has highlighted that as well. What are your thoughts on that?
The good thing about the dialogue around this is it's finally focused on where it should have always been, which is the way the law is interpreted and implemented by judges. And it was always the case that so many of the incidents that people cited the bail laws for were bailable offenses. In other words, bail could have been set, but judges chose not to set it. And it's interesting to me to see that all of the people who for years were clamoring for judicial discretion, that was the mantra, right? The bail reform laws have denied us judicial discretion. And so we clarified the law. We made it absolutely crystal clear that judges have this discretion. And now they have a problem with the discretion the judges are using. So it is an unfortunate political football that people have used to exploit New Yorkers' fears of crime. Fortunately, crime seems to be on the downswing. We love that that's the case. It is still too high as long as people are victims of crime and people fear becoming victims of crime. We need to do everything we can do to address that. But the bail laws have been used as such a scapegoat to keep people from focusing on where the problem really lies, which is doing something to deal with the mental health problems that a lot of these perpetrators have, doing something to help solve crimes. The clearance rate of crimes is remarkably low, and I think it would startle people to know how often someone who commits a crime gets away with it. And for me, if you're dealing with someone who's contemplating committing a crime, are they going to sit there and wonder whether the specifics of the act they're about to take would be bail eligible or not? Or are they going to think about, there's a really good shot I'll never get caught? And so if we focus on addressing the clearance rate problems and addressing some of the root causes of what leads to crime, we'd do a lot further than just pointing at the bail laws as a fake out for people.
And it also needs to be said in this conversation that in some instances, when we talk about judicial discretion around setting bail, that often is simply a proxy for saying set a high bail so it is actually just pretrial detention. Right? Because you're dealing with so many people who are not going to be able to post a exceedingly high bail. And you're talking about just a way to ensure that, especially in this case, multiple repeat offenders are just simply held in.
Of course. And that's what this was all about. This was never about judicial discretion. And that's being exposed right now, because the more judges are exercising their discretion, the more the same people who were clamoring for judicial discretion are now complaining about judicial discretion.
But that doesn't mean that the use of judicial discretion in a lenient way isn't causing some sort of problem.
Oh, no, I'm just pointing out the hypocrisy of people who are pointing at the laws as the problem when what they really want to do is imprison more people, and particularly poor people, because when you're talking about the bail laws, it almost never affects the wealthy because they have the money to pay bail, no matter where it's set. And this is why the reforms were necessary in the first place, because people who don't have means, who don't have the economic wherewithal, end up getting held in jail pending trial, not even having been convicted yet. And it destroys their lives, increases recidivism, by the way. If we're concerned about recidivism, holding people in jail for a few months before the trial doesn't help. It hurts. And so the contradictions and the hypocrisy and people who are trying to exploit this issue just frustrate me so much, more than any particular issue I've dealt with in my two decades in public service.
So in addition to what you mentioned about increasing mental health care, and there's been steps that the state has taken on that in recent years and more being proposed this year by the governor and her policy and budget agendas, in addition to that, and clearly there's issues around speedy trial, are there any other ways to solve some of these problems with people who seemingly, according to the mayor and NYPD, and there's obviously lots of reasons to be skeptical about some of their claims and statistics, because we've seen flaws in some of that before, but obviously some of it's accurate, potentially a lot of it's accurate. Are there ways to solve this? I mean, are there a number of instances here where you do think that judges need to be setting a high bail as a proxy for, you know, pre-trial remand?
No is the short answer. But look, mental health is a very big part of the problem. So we can agree on that and put that to the side. That needs to be addressed. And that would solve a very large number of the incidents and crimes that we're seeing committed. Outside of that basket of incidents, if you will, we like to focus on data. I like to focus on data and analytics, and let's look at what works and what doesn't work, which is another reason the bail conversation has been so frustrating. But we know that when poverty goes up, when people don't have opportunities, when people lose hope, they are more drawn to lives of crime. That's not to justify what they're doing or to say they should be doing it. But we just know as a matter of data, that is true. So if we address that, if we provide people opportunities, if we provide people economic hope, you'll see crime go down. It's a fact. I mean, this is not something that's in dispute. It's not as effective politically, where you can go out and beat your chest and say you lock someone behind bars and seem like a tough guy. But in fact, it works way better. And so what we know is, unless you're going to lock someone away forever, when I don't think even the craziest advocates would want a life sentence for some of the low-level crimes we're talking about, the nonviolent crimes. But that's the only way to keep those people from doing it again. If you put them in jail, the likelihood of them committing other crime is significantly higher. And so we just haven't tackled this problem in a way that is sober thinking and effective. And instead, we have the demagoguery through the roof on this. And it's unfortunate. I do think that as crime has gone down, you've seen the attention to the bail issue also decrease, because that's generally what happens, is there's an issue people are concerned about, are fearful of, and then the political opportunists exploit it and tell them who's to blame, often with misinformation.
Bail is an issue that sort of applies to this broader question, which is, we are more than a couple of years now into Governor Hochul's tenure. She obviously came in towards the end of Governor Andrew Cuomo's third term, won her own term in the 2022 election, and, you know, now has had some real time to settle into the role, work with the legislature. Bail became a contentious issue between the governor and the legislature. But zoom way out here, as we get into discussing both the redistricting process that you were so involved with and the budget negotiations that are now really about to ramp up ahead of the April 1st start of the new state fiscal year. And obviously there's a lot of talk that the state budget will probably pass sometime in April after the start of the new fiscal year, as often happens, but we'll get back to that in a minute. But as we're getting into all this, just zoom way out and say a little bit about sort of the working relationship between at least your state Senate majority and the governor's office under Governor Hochul, and where there's some positives and where there's still perhaps some challenges in that relationship. There were obviously some harsh words thrown around related to housing policy negotiations that fell apart. We can get back to that specific issue in a few minutes as well, but also about sort of the volume of bills that the legislature passed last year and how the governor was approaching that and some of the vetoes. And so how is the relationship between the legislature and the governor's office?
Well, look, our system of government is designed to have a natural tension between the branches of government. Right? You can't have checks and balances if everyone's patting each other on the back all the time. So the disagreements are going to come. What's important is that they're handled with respect for each another's role in the process. And I think with Governor Hochul, we've seen huge improvement. I mean, Andrew Cuomo was probably a low point in terms of the relationship between the branches of government, because he didn't have a lot of respect for anyone other than himself. And so we have seen the day-to-day interactions, I think, much improved, and that's a good thing for the people of the state ultimately. But we're going to have disagreements, as we do. We have different beliefs about certain issues and how the state should address them. That's completely normal and not at all a negative, but I think a positive in terms of what it does for the people of the state. We want people with different ideas, bouncing them off each other, getting in the arena of ideas and battling it out to see what's actually best. So it doesn't bother me at all. I think the relationship is significantly better than it was.
And what about this issue of a lack of the two super majorities in the legislature, even sort of seemingly even considering veto overrides, the governor vetoing quite a few bills? There's timing issues, but you also have some control over those timing issues in terms of sending bills to the governor's desk to move the process along earlier in the year so that you could potentially override vetoes if you wanted to before the holidays, let's say, and, you know, in December. As Senate Deputy Leader, have you thought about this at all? Is there any way in which the legislature has discussed or thinking about taking a different tact?
We talked about it all the time, and we discussed it with our members. But a couple of things about that. Number one is that there are different tools in the toolbox for using your leverage, achieving your goals legislatively. Overriding a veto is a very aggressive way to try and achieve that. And we just talked about the relationship. You want a relationship that's going to be one in which people feel comfortable giving on issues to get something done and not always being confrontational. If we go down a road of just passing bills and overriding vetoes anytime we feel like it, we would have to have unanimity amongst our members in the Senate to do that. That often is not the case. The Assembly would have to have near unanimity. And we would also need to be partners in that effort. And I think all that is to say, it's a very difficult maneuver to pull off on a regular basis. So I think if it comes to be something that is deemed necessary in a particular case, I would absolutely advocate that we do that. But, you know, there are people who look at every single bill as vetoed and say, why don't you go override it? Well, we can't do that. Like, it just wouldn't work. We wouldn't have the votes. We wouldn't, it would poison the relationship between the branches. And so we have to be a little more strategic about that. What I would say is that the existence of the supermajorities changes the outcome and changes the dynamic, because whether we do it or not, everybody involved knows it can be done if the rubber meets the road. And so negotiations take on a different tenor. The relative leverage each side has in the conversation is different. It has been significant, I think, in achieving concessions on a number of issues that these supermajorities exist, whether we take the step to override a veto or not. And of course, unrelated to the governor, but we just used our supermajorities last week in a very important way in passing the congressional district line. So it's not as if these numbers that we have in both houses are not necessary.
Perfect segue. Thank you. So, and it does seem like the negotiations over policy are a really key area where that leverage is so obvious and key. And that goes back to even before you had supermajorities, just, you know, some of the ways that the new dynamics in 2019 played out, you know, around things like updates to the rent laws, for example, where Governor Cuomo saw some of the writing on the wall related to what the legislature was starting to move on and things of that nature.
Exactly. Exactly. Go on.
Yeah. So on redistricting, so I don't want to go back through all the process here. You know, there's been a lot written on that. You've done interviews with other places and outlets that people can find, really getting into all the ins and outs of redistricting. But just, I would like for you to explain to people, you specifically, what's your role in this? Like, how does Senate Deputy Leader Mike Gennaris sort of factor into these decisions? Are you really the main sort of power broker here in deciding what the legislature, or at least the state Senate, because of your dual roles as deputy leader and also on the campaign side, are you sort of the person that's really sort of spearheading on the Senate side the conversations around what to do about maps that are presented from the redistricting commission and what the state Senate's going to do and things like that? Or what's your specific role in all this behind the scenes? Let us in a little bit on that.
Well, an initial matter, whatever I do on this issue or on any issue, is as a representative of the body, right? Ultimately, the Senate has to vote on these things, and that my colleagues need to feel comfortable supporting whatever is presented to them. But it's actually, to answer your question more specifically, it's a third hat I wear that gives me the role on redistricting. There is an entity called the Legislative Task Force on Demographics and Reapportionment, I think, or something like that. Which is known by the acronym LATFOR, that I am the co-chair of on the Senate side, and Assemblymember Zabrowski has that role on the Assembly side. That is an entity that is tasked with redistricting for the legislature. And so when it comes time for the legislature to draw its own maps or to analyze maps that are presented to us or to look at the demographics of the state as it relates to the district lines, it's that entity that does that work.
And who else gets the biggest voices in the decisions that task force takes on? Is it members of Congress? Is it, you know, because they're obviously representative of the current, whatever the current district lines may be. Obviously, you're taking into account feedback from New Yorkers that have happened over public meetings or that you're getting in your districts or you're seeing elsewhere. But who else gets a big voice in that process? How much do you consult with, you know, members of Congress about their current districts or their future districts?
Well, we hear from everybody. There have been public hearings. We hear from members of Congress, of both parties, by the way. Sure. I was contacted by people who are advocating for their lines from the other side of the aisle, which is, you know, kind of an interesting and strange experience, but nonetheless, that happens. Interest groups, communities throughout the state that are affected. We really hear from everyone. But ultimately, who makes the decisions with your question? It's the members of the legislature. It really is that simple. I and Assemblymember Zabrowski do play the lead role in doing the work with the staff at LATFOR. And then, of course, the speaker and the majority leader of the Senate are ultimately decision makers. In terms of what gets presented to the members. But then we have a conference like we do with any item of legislation. We go through it, we discuss it with the members, and we come out with the final product that has the support of the body. Those are the decision makers. Everything else is just people's opinions that may or may not be taken into account at the end of the day.
Let's look ahead in a minute to how you might want to adjust this redistricting process where the state redraws its state legislative and congressional maps after each census. This process was the first under reforms that were passed back, I believe, in 2014 by constitutional amendment. And then there were some tweaks to different processes made by the legislature. And then obviously things wound up in court that determined a lot of what went on here. So this was very messy after the 2014 reforms in the first test run here. And so there's a lot of calls for changes to the process ahead of the next round, assuming that this round is now over, which we're getting some indications it may very well be. Before we talk about your fixes that you want to make to the process moving forward, let me ask you about two things that I'm wondering if you have regrets on around this process. There's two spots where it seems like there might be some room for that retrospective, you know, Monday morning quarterbacking here. One is, should you have tried to force the Independent Redistricting Commission back to work before this process got into the courts? Should you have tried to force the commission to pass a second map or a second set of maps, which is ultimately what in the most recent ruling the Court of Appeals said had to have happened? So they restarted that process, and then the commission did pass a second map and send it to you for your decision making in the legislature. So should you have tried to compel that to try to avoid what happened here, A? And B, I don't know how else to discuss it other than saying, should you in the legislature have been less ambitious with your redrawing and some would say gerrymandering of the congressional districts that led to part of the challenge last time as well? So on those two pieces, do you have any regrets, any retrospective thoughts on those two decisions that you made?
I would say no. I mean, you mentioned at the beginning the process was messy. It certainly was. It was also very predictable in the sense that going back 10 years to 2014, the Democrats in the Senate opposed this concept for precisely the reasons that we have seen it break down. A 5-5 commission broken along party lines is just designed for failure. And that's what happened, unfortunately. To answer your question, what should we have compelled? You said, should we have compelled
tried to compel the commission
right, to avoid court? The only way to compel the commission would be to go to court.
Sure.
Compel them to meet. And of course, this was an unprecedented situation. We believed that there was a process in place for the intentional gridlock at the commission to then revert to the legislature. The Court of Appeals, and what I think will go down as one of the more notorious and wrong-headed decisions that's ever made, stripped the legislature of its constitutional right and power over redistricting, and decided that even though the commission clearly was deadlocked and would not have agreed, that doesn't mean it goes to the legislature until technically they meet and not agree in a meeting. It's nonsensical. Fortunately, the chief judge of that court who wrote the opinion is no more, because she had to resign under a cloud of scandal. That is what it is. But we're now dealing with the aftermath of that. We had a Court of Appeals now that was smart enough to order a retry, and now we've come out with a much better product as a result. So long way of saying, I suppose we could have gone to court and tried to force that commission to meet at the time. Remember, the time frame was very narrow. We were already pushing the primary date off into August for Congress. So it seemed at the time a more efficient way to go about it, just to proclaim their own deadlock, but just to accept that and move forward. In fact, there was a law in place that said that could happen. The court decided that law didn't apply. So that's thing number one. On the second part, it's a similar answer. We came up with a map that I believe complied with constitutional standards and did so in a way that respected the right of the legislature to play this role. I've already expressed myself on this Court of Appeals decision. I think they were wrong. It was a very narrow decision. It was 4-3. Even if they had thought that the maps were somehow flawed, the constitutional requirement is to send them back with directions on where to correct them, not to just hand the power over to a Republican judge from a small upstate county who then in turn delegated it to an out-of-state person who doesn't know first thing about the various communities in New York State. So like I said, this Court of Appeals took corrective action to reestablish the role, the proper role of the various parties here, and we came out with a better result at the end of the day.
So now all that being said, in this new draw of the maps, you decided to be far less, again, let's say ambitious with a redraw of the districts. There's no New York 11 that includes Staten Island and goes into Park Slope. There, you decided not to, you had previously created a New York 3 that had a very dramatic design to it, let's say, going across the Long Island Sound. You left the new New York 12 in place where previously the Congress members Nadler and Carolyn Maloney had been combined into a district that Jerry Nadler now represents. You decided to make very modest changes to what the commission passed. Was that a factor of not of wanting to be very careful that this didn't wind up back in court? Was it a factor of the calendar again being very tight here with petitioning beginning? Because you're getting some heat from different quarters about not sort of being more ambitious with the map drawing.
Yeah, it's actually funny. I ran into one of my friends on the left at a public event this past weekend, and this person says to me, "Oh, you didn't do enough. You didn't push the maps enough." So I said, "What would you like us to have done? Basically, what we did 2 years ago?" No, you'd gone too far on that one. So I said, okay, let's break it down. So that map had 22 out of 26 districts that went for Joe Biden. This map has 20 out of 26 districts that went for Joe Biden. So I said, if you don't want the 22-4, but you don't think the 20-6 is good enough, where did you want us to go? 21-5, like right down the middle? Oh. It's silly, of course. And more importantly, we have constitutional standards we have to abide by that don't involve trying to maximize one party success or failure. And in fact, that's one of the things that's not permitted, explicitly not permitted in the Constitution. So we took our task seriously. There was a law that said you cannot deviate from the map the commission presents to you by more than 2% per district. We ended up having to go beyond that standard, which we're permitted to do because that was a law. This is a law, right? So one law can supersede another. Mm-hmm.
As opposed to a constitutional amendment.
Correct. We wanted to at least honor the principle of that standard. And so while we went over 2% per district, it was relatively minor deviation above that. And if you look at the state as a whole, we were approximately 2%, which means 98% of the people in the state continue to reside in the same congressional district they did before all of this happened. So why did we do that? Because, yes, we wanted to ensure we would sit court scrutiny because the calendar was tight. And frankly, because I'm not the only one making this decision. There's senators, there's assembly members, there's other partners. The governor has to ultimately sign the bill. Everyone has their opinions and we have to come to consensus. And so at the end of the day, I think we came up with a very good map. It can be judged in November, to be honest, because that's when you'll see how people perform.
Yeah. And go ahead, please. Sorry.
Well, I was doing one of the other interviews you referenced and the question was, well, why didn't you do something more in a particular district? And that district that was referenced was one that Biden won as when he ran for president 4 years ago by double digits. And I said, it's not up to me to make sure there's a Biden plus 20 district to make sure a Democrat wins. If you're in a Biden plus 10 district, go run a good candidate and win your election. that should be on the campaigns and the candidates at that point.
That's along the lines of what I was going to say is that, this conversation is also, we're obviously talking about the redistricting process, so we're focused on that. But this also, many conversations sort of also leave out candidates and campaigns, not all of them.
Well, I find it laughable. Like you're actually suggesting that we should have drawn a map that was in excess of a double digit victory for one party because the candidates don't do well enough to win in that environment. Like that's that's really not on us. It's on the candidates and on the campaigns. And, you know, I always point out that in 2022, which was a rough year for the congressional Democrats in New York, we achieved supermajorities in the Assembly and in the Senate, and in the Senate with lines drawn by the special master. So, you know, it can be done. We ran good campaigns, we had great candidates, and we won in some of these same places where the congressional candidates were not successful. So at some point, it's really up to the people whose names are on the ballots, and hopefully they'll do great this year. I hope they succeed. Lord knows the country needs them to succeed. And I'll be doing everything I can to help them politically. But as it relates to the redistricting process, we did things within the constitutional standards that were presented to us, and we did it in a very effective way, I think.
And lastly on that, are you starting to craft a change to this process? Will we see first passage of a new constitutional amendment this year? Or because obviously this is the second year of this legislature. So if you were to pass a constitutional amendment this year, then you could pass it in one of the next 2 years and it would go before voters either in 25 or 26 and have things in place well ahead of the next census. Is that something you're looking at? Or are you going to change the redistricting process?
Well, right now, we're just catching our breath from having finished a very torturous 2 year process to get to get to where we landed. There's no rush on this. You mentioned it could be 25 or 26. It could be 27 or 28. Or frankly, it could be 29 or 30 because the next reapportionment's not till 2032. So we have time to think about this in a sober fashion and try and get it right. I think a little bit of time before we do that is probably a good thing because everyone's got very strong opinions about the process we just went through. Some of them are emotionally held positions. So it might be not the worst thing to have a cooling off period before we reevaluate the whole thing.
Give me your one sort of overriding principle about how you would think about changes. Is it making it sort of an independent commission rather than a bipartisan one? Is it changing the makeup of a commission to have it not have an even number of people?
It sounds simple and strange, but I do think having an odd number instead of even would be beneficial. The problem with that is how do you divide them to the point where, one side doesn't feel they're getting an advantage or disadvantaged. But we've seen this with our boards of elections and numerous other instances. When you go for an approach that just gives both political sides equal representation, you're just begging for gridlock and dysfunction. And lo and behold, that's what happened here. One side or the other deems it to their advantage to not participate. They refuse to show up to meetings. You don't have a quorum. You can't pass the map. You can't even vote on a map, which would have met the procedural standard, and you get stuck. So it's been an issue in so many commissions that are set up or task forces legislatively, not just on redistricting, but the question is, how do you set up a body that's separate from the legislature, but is not influenced by various forces to the point where, in an effort to keep the legislature out of control, you're handing it to someone else? It's hard to have a truly independent an unbiased group of people. And so that's the trick, doing it in a way that you have a legitimate pool of objective, unbiased participants. And it's very hard to do.
Yeah. All right, let me get you on a few things related to the state budget process that's quickly unfolding here. You have as a top priority, correct me if I'm wrong, but you've been out there on this additional investment that you want the state to make in bus service. It's under this banner of getting, get congestion pricing right. So as congestion pricing is implemented in New York City, you want to see a big investment in bus service in the city. You're obviously a key voice in developing the state Senate's One House budget resolution. Is that going to be in there? What's the status of that proposal? Do you think the governor is going to be on board with that? Say a little bit about that specific item in your
priorities. Well, it's important, and I want to talk about why it's important. Whether it's going to be in the One House, you'll have to wait till Monday to find out. It's not my place to announce things for the conference in that regard. But suffice to say, I look forward to continuing to fight for this issue to the end of the month and hopefully getting it into the budget. The reason we came up with this proposal was in looking at other cities around the world that have implemented a similar plan. The ones that were most effective all did the same thing, which is invest heavily in public transit in the lead up to a congestion pricing scheme. London did it, a couple of other places did it, particularly in bus service. Because if you're telling people we're imposing this this toll on you so that you don't drive your car, we're encouraging them to get out of their cars because we're trying to alleviate congestion, you got to give them somewhere to go because people still need to get to work. They still need to get to their appointments. In the absence of a viable public transit option, people will continue to drive and just pay and be angry about it. And so what we're trying to do is to really take bus service, which I'm afraid in this city is an option of last resort for a lot of people. Like, I don't know a lot of people that are like, wait, I'm going to take the bus. That's like the way I want to get around. They do it because they have to. Either they don't have subway service or for a variety of other reasons, they're kind of backed into it. What we need to do is get people to reimagine bus service, have them think about it as a viable way to get around the city. The way to do that is to invest heavily in improving service. Now, there's been a lot of talk about bus infrastructure. The mayor is behind in building out bus lanes throughout the city. He needs to do that. He would have my support and putting his foot on the gas, no pun intended, on that. But we spoke to the MTA about what can we do short of that, because that's out of our control right now in terms of implementing that, that can be put into place immediately and have a real impact. And they said $45 million for increased bus service would help us increase frequency of buses, make them more reliable, and would have a real beneficial impact on commuters. And so we proposed that. The second piece of it was making it, again, getting people to reimagine how bus service works, is expanding on this pilot program we established last year of fare-free bus routes. There's now one such route in each borough. They have been wildly successful, I think perhaps beyond many one's hopes even. The ridership is up in excess of 20% on these lines, which, you know, makes sense. You tell someone they're going to ride around for free, the more people are going to do it. But even though it's simple in that respect, it's important because post-pandemic, we have been struggling to get people back on public transit. It increases the viability of the system. It increases the safety of the system. We started this conversation about safety on the subways, but the more people are on our subways and buses, the safer they become. Anyone who's been on a subway platform at night and no one else is on there except one person that's concerning, it's a much scarier proposition than if there's 100 people with you on that platform or on a bus. And so increasing the ridership will go a long way towards increasing the ridership, right? It feeds on itself. And so we're really pleased to see that has been as successful as it has been, and we want to increase it to 3 routes per borough now, 15 throughout the city, instead of just the 5 routes that we currently have. And that would be another $45 million. So the total package would be $90 million in assistance for the MTA to implement these changes.
Not to go into it any further, but obviously you hit on a key issue, which is, you know, you can keep putting money into bus service, but also if the city's management of the streets and the bus lanes is not what it needs to be, you're going to, you know, not get the bang for your buck there. And so there's, I think, a lot of questions about, as you got at, the way the city is not meeting actually its own legal mandates to build out bus lanes.
Correct.
And we've discussed that on this show in other episodes, so I won't go into it.
Well, I'll just say they absolutely need to do that. Mm-hmm. Jana Lieber, who has been like a real breath of fresh air in terms of leading that agency and working with us on it, crashed our press conference on this plan to say that we need more bus lanes in addition to this money. But the figure we arrived at, the $45 million for the bus service, was specifically designed to kind of ask the question of what can we do? How much can we do short of the bus lanes being built out the way they're supposed to? And that was the figure the MTA gave us that could be effective in increasing and improving service immediately. If we succeed in getting this $45 million, the next step will be to insist on the bus lanes being implemented the way they're legally mandated to, because we're kind of reach our limit of what we can do without the infrastructure improving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've sort of been waiting for Riders Alliance or some other group to file some sort of suit against the city for not following that streets plan law. But that's a matter for another time, and also gets into fascinating things around, in many cases, it seems you all in the state government have too much power over New York City. But then when you see New York City not doing things like this, you wonder, how Albany can step in, as you were just getting at. Let me ask you a couple quick things before I let you go. A couple other quick things. Housing policy negotiations. Are you going to get to a deal in the budget? Let's not go into all the specifics. I want to get you out of here on time, but can you tell people, this is obviously a huge area of focus. Is that something that you think will happen in the budget, or is that going to be more for the weeks of session afterward to try to get to a three-way deal on a variety of housing policy? Where are we at on that?
Too soon to tell whether we can do it in the next 3 weeks, or it might take a little longer, but I will say the deal is just sitting there waiting to be made. Tenant protections, good cause, eviction protections on the one hand, incentives to build more affordable housing on the other. That way you increase the stock, you give people who are looking for homes more opportunities to find them. And then you also protect people in their existing homes. If you do one without the other, you're not really solving the problem. If everyone who's involved in these discussions realizes that that's the answer, ultimately, we can get there pretty quickly. But up until now, the developers have been influencing their allies to not even discuss protecting tenants in their homes, which is just a crazy and outrageous thing to think about when you realize how much evictions are once again increasing post-pandemic. If people look at this objectively and come to the table with goodwill, we can get something done pretty quickly, I think.
Are there any other top pieces of a housing deal that you personally think have to be in there? There's obviously a state housing voucher program that's been debated now for a number of years. There's the governor's proposal around pro-housing communities getting this discretionary grant access only if they're pro-housing communities. The city has several other planks to its housing agenda that the mayor and his team have put forward. Are there other pieces that you think are sort of musts in that deal?
Well, there are a lot of tentacles to this problem. For me, the broad strokes, what we just talked about, are the most important. Build new affordable homes and also protect people in the homes they already have. But Senator Kavanaugh, our housing chair, has done a tremendous amount of work on the other aspects of this problem. You mentioned vouchers. That's been something he's been championing for a good while, doing what's necessary to make sure that apartments that have fallen in disrepair can be rehabbed in a way that makes financial sense. The list goes on and on. Mm-hmm. And I do think that on most of this stuff, they're resolvable disagreements if we get the big picture dealt with.
Yeah. All right. I'll let you go. Give me a date. What's your non-binding date you think a state budget's going to pass? It's obviously going to be in April or maybe even May sometime, right?
I don't think it'll get to May. But what's tricky about this year is the deadline of March 31st falls on Easter Sunday. For most observers. And so you have a Good Friday, you have Easter weekend, which is going to complicate things. If we're not done, the leader, Andrew Stewart Cousins, if you ask this question, she says, we're either going to be done earlier or we're going to be done late. We're not going to be done
obviously
right on time
because
right on time is actually Easter. So if I had to guess, I'd say we kick into the first week or two of April, but it shouldn't kick into May, certainly.
Yeah. And mayoral control of New York City schools won't be done in the budget, right?
I hope not. It requires more discussion and more input from stakeholders than just throwing it in as a bargaining chip at the end of the 11th hour of the budget.
All right. Senate Deputy Leader Michael Gennaris, any last thing that we didn't get to, you just want to throw one more shout out to that you're working on? Anything particular, last comment here?
Well, what we really need to do is restore the education cuts that the governor has proposed. There's been some good progress on that in this last week, but to suggest that half our school districts in the state receive less money than they were budgeting for is a real problem for many of us. And I think everyone realizes that was probably not the best idea at this point. So hopefully we'll resolve that. But that's a priority for myself and a lot of our members.
As you got at with the increased revenue forecasts, the governor's budget director even sort of indicated that that's exactly where some of that could be sent to sort of nullify that issue. That gets us into a whole another discussion about whether education funding always has to continue just going up, 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 even after the pandemic bumps. But we won't go into that now. We'll save that for another time. It's an election year, like the last time. I think hopefully you'll come back on to talk more politics as the election year proceeds. Can we check back in as the races really start to unfold for state legislature and Congress a little later this spring?
Of course. Well, it's always a pleasure to be on with you, Ben.
Very good. Thanks for all the time.
All right. Thank you.